For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Well, my friends, it looks like the establishment has given up on Iraq. The Central Intelligence Agency has just released a new national intelligence estimate. The Council on Foreign Relations has just released a new report coming to pretty much the same conclusion that the cause is lost to set up a new multi-ethnic central state in the land formerly known as Iraq. And also it's been reported that the Pentagon has begun drawing up plans for what to do after the eventual American defeat, approximately a year from now, according to their planning. In Iraq, 3,000 people were killed just last month. The U.S. casualty rate is the highest it's been since the spring of 2004, when the Army was fighting full-scale battles in Fallujah and Najaf at the same time. More than 3,000 American soldiers have been killed, tens of thousands of them have been wounded, and a lot of Americans wonder, how the hell did we get into this mess? What happened? Well, my guest, Karen Katowski, had a front row view, and she's here to explain what happened. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Well, good to be here.
It's great to talk to you again. I guess I ought to give you a little bit better introduction. Karen Katowski was a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force, now retired. She worked at the Near East South Asia desk at the Pentagon with a front row view to the Office of Special Plans. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. For about 10 or 11 months, directly working for Bill Luty, who was also in charge of Abe Schulsky. So Abe's Office of Special Plans was our sister organization, and for 3 months in the summer of 2002, we actually shared office space. We were all together, so I got to get to know, at least superficially, some of the folks that later constituted the Office of Special Plans, of course, the topic of that IG report.
Right, and now I guess that's my first question, really, is did the Inspector General come and interview you about what you witnessed there?
Actually, they did. They did. Apparently, the IG was initiated, I think, at the request of some congressmen. I'm sure that's public knowledge, and I don't know which ones, but some of the guys in Congress who really felt that this was, needed to be looked into and that the Pentagon would not do it without being pushed, asked for this investigation, I think, about 14, 15 months ago. And last March, almost a year ago, several folks from the IG team working on this question came out to where I live, and we sat in McDonald's, the local McDonald's here in Woodstock, Virginia, and we sat there for about 2.5 hours and chatted. And I was actually, I was happy, of course, to participate. I was surprised that they'd waited 4 months to come and see me. I was extremely surprised at how ignorant they were of how things work, and even of names and things that had been widely published, not just by me, but by lots of investigative reporters by 2006. I mean, lots of this information was out there, and yet they seemed very innocent, and I use that word carefully, but they seemed very innocent of what was going on. And they explained their ignorance and their innocence to me by saying that members of the IG are picked purposely to be ignorant of what it is they're looking into.
Sort of like a jury.
Kind of nutty, but okay. That's what they told me. So they had a lot to learn. And I kind of insulted them at the end of our conversation, not on purpose, but I just said, look, I said, it is going to be extremely difficult for you to successfully and honestly do this thing that you've been chartered to do, which is to find out if this organization is producing pseudo-intelligence, presenting it as if it was real intelligence, and in doing so, accelerating or gaining an unnecessary and illegal war. It's going to be tough to do what you are going to have to do, and I told them I didn't think they'd be able to do it, and never heard from them again until, and I still haven't, but of course, I haven't heard from them, but the report's out. So I haven't seen it, but from what I hear and looking at the executive summary, they probably pushed as hard as they could, and I think to their credit, because even the current policy guy, Ed Edelman, was very angry about this. So I think they must have worked really hard on it, and I give them credit for that.
Well, did you get a load of Douglas Feith defending himself over the
weekend?
I got a
load. I got a boatload of Douglas Feith.
Well, he told the Washington Post that, hey, listen, all I did was critique intelligence, which
that's
is
all he did.
Perfectly okay, and just because I submitted a report doesn't mean that I endorsed its substance.
That's right. And then later he goes on to say, and actually, I just, didn't George Tenet say that? I was just saying what George said. You know, oh, what a loser. But yes, he has a, it's funny, I think less than the words that Doug Feith is saying, and I've read several and listened to several of his interviews in the past several days since that IG report came out, which said that he had not done anything illegal, but had certainly, in producing alternative stories and presenting them as if they were substantiated, he did something very inappropriate, and certainly you would expect actions to be taken just on that. He was very angry, and he's been on the talk circuit defending himself, and it's really, I think it's telling. One is how quickly and how angrily they are responding, and number two, that the best response they have is to put Doug Feith on public television. That's just insane. He does himself no favors, and that's all they've got. That's all they've got to defend their story, is to put Doug Feith on there where he can sputter and spit, you know, and claim, you know, these circular arguments that, oh, well, I didn't do anything but what Congress is doing. I was just criticizing intelligence. You know, it's kind of crazy. I think the IG has done its work. I think they have made many people that are involved in this very angry, and that's a good thing. And they've probably given the congressman some meat to chew on here as they go forth and find ways to really get to the bottom of it. Now, having said all that, it's 2007. We've killed, I mean, I don't know how many innocent Iraqis are displaced, exited their country, dead, wounded, starving to death, sick because of what we've done to their water system. You know, I mean, the studies go up to, I think, what, 650,000 Iraqis dead because of our actions. We've got all our Americans dead and wounded. We're not doing anything to take care of our poor guys coming back with no legs and arms and eyes. You know,
or with the mental problems that they're coming back with.
What mental problems? Yeah, that's the Army's answer. You know, what mental problems? You know, but yes, indeed. And we're, and I mean, think of anyway.
Right.
It's
no.
It's nice. It's a little bit late. And not only that, if anyone goes back, and I went back to see what I had written in 2003.
Yeah, me too.
But I mean, just to see, because, you know, for me, it's kind of old news now in a way. And I look back to see it, and I'm like, man, it's been said, people. You know,
truly,
a revelation.
Right. I mean, honestly, you came out, you wrote the new Pentagon Papers for Salon. You wrote in Rumsfeld's shop for the American Conservative.
Right?
For Knight Ritter newspapers.
My first op-ed came out right the very month that I retired, and I was free legally to speak, I guess you could say.
And this is the beginning of the summer of 2003, right?
That's
just
right.
After the war.
Yeah, and not only that, there were plenty of people. Antiwar.com has their archives, lots of your writers, lots of thinkers, lots of professors, lots of politicians. All said, even before, even in the summer of 2002, they saw what was going on and publicly articulated the problems. And nobody was listening, so it's a mystery to me how we do these things. I mean, we have gone to war. We have destroyed a country. It is we need to think of a symbol so we can say the country formerly known as Iraq. You know, let's do a prince thing. We'll just design something, and that's about how ludicrous it is. No, there's no Iraq. Iran and the whole region is in disarray, in large part, because of precisely what Doug Feith wanted to do, which was to get our troops in there. And, you know, we're not even talking about some of the important things that are going on today. Forget the dead people. We ought to be talking about that. We're not talking about those permanent military bases. What's that about? What's that about? You know, isn't that, to me, that seems to be the real reason that we're there, to construct those bases, to shift our forces.
To move our troops north from Saudi Arabia to the next country up
Absolutely,
from there.
Absolutely, because when the Saudis fall, just like Richard Pearl wrote in his little book, An End to Evil, Richard Pearl said, well, when the Saudi House of Saud falls, we'll just, from our bases in Iraq, go get their oil.
Yeah.
And we'll husband it. You know, we'll just take care of it. It's not about oil. We wouldn't do something like that. We just want to be, you know, paternalistic about the oil. Well, it's just wrong. It's so wrong. And we're not talking The Congress isn't even talking about, you know, they're worrying about 20,000 troops. How are we going to turn those bases over to Iraqis, and which Iraqis might we turn them over to?
Right, I guess it just depends on where they're built.
Well, sure.
Do you know where they built? Are they all up in the north and the south near the oil fields?
They're scattered. You've got two in the central, one in the Kurdish land, I think, and then I think there's one in the south, a big one. Now, we have other bases, too, other facilities, and we rebuilt and strengthened a lot of Saddam's facilities. I mean, we're just, I mean, if the Iraqis can see us for what we are, and here we are fussing about, did Doug Feist do something inappropriate? Well, of course he did, and we knew it years ago, and it's just frustrating. I don't want to pick on the IG. I think they had a hard job, and it seems as if they, it seems as if that they rose to my challenge, you know, to really try to do something in the face of hostility within the Pentagon, and it seems like they might have done that. I hope that's a good thing, but it's certainly not enough.
When you hear Seymour Hersh say that 8 or 9 guys took this country to war, does that sound right to you?
Well, 8 or 9 guys and their lackeys in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Times. I mean, yeah.
Right, and MSNBC and Fox News.
And CNN.
That's
yeah.
what it was. So it was 8 or 9 guys plus everyone in news media.
Plus
in this
a harem.
Country.
8 or 9 guys plus a harem of prostitutes in the news media. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And actually, I'm not a student of this, but it's possible that this is not actually abnormal, but this is how many wars work.
Right.
And this was just our time to witness it, or at least my time to witness it up close and personal in some ways.
Right. And now, for the average person who may not know about this stuff in detail like this, I mean, what we're talking about, what you talk about in, for example, your article for Salon, the Pentagon Papers, you said that Bill Luddy called General Zinni a traitor. For being opposed to the war.
Well,
and,
yes,
and
he did.
Colin Powell also.
Sure. Well, he didn't call them traitors until they did something about their opposition. As long as they were silently opposed, as long as they didn't get in the way, they were fine. But, yeah, Zinni in November, late November, when he was actually displaced, or I don't know if he stepped down or was asked to step down, but he had been President Bush's Middle East envoy. About the time that he ended that term of service as the Middle East envoy, he spoke out publicly, saying that, you know, this was a mad rush for no reason. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but basically critical of the kinds of things that Feist was doing and that Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld were doing with this thing. That was the time that's the time frame where Luddy calls him a traitor. And the same with Powell in Powell's efforts to get them, as a good State Department guy might do, you know, get them to go back to the UN and get to try to replay maybe something that Powell probably remembered from 1990, you know, try to get the world on board so that we don't have to pay the cost of this thing. But they were very angry at him for successfully doing that. Now, when he was trying to do that, he wasn't a traitor, but when he succeeded, then he was enemy number one.
Right. And now this ought to be, I think, really telling for the audience that this is a pretty severe kind of little cabal that's taken over when somebody who, I guess not so much anymore ever since he went along with them, but up until this point, Colin Powell's one of the most celebrated American personalities. I mean, for them to be marginalizing a guy with as much power and influence as him, they must have really had something going on there.
Well, it's not clear where their power comes from, but, you know, you've heard the phrase, fake it till you make it. They certainly believed in themselves. I think they believed in the justness of destroying Iraq. They believed in the justness of changing our footprint, our military footprint, not through negotiations and treaties, but through force, which is what we've done. You know, there's no status of forces agreement between our military people in Iraq and any Iraqi government. There's no SOFA, and there's no agreement for those bases. And that's exactly how we like it, because those agreements take years and lots of dollars to negotiate, and we don't want that. So, they had an agenda, and they felt, I'm sure, that it was good for America. I'm not sure also that, given the background of these people, given their public statements, given the documents that Feist and Pearl and a lot of these guys have participated in, I'm not sure also that they weren't thinking about, an agenda, a Likudnik agenda. Now, it's pretty clear that they were influenced by that, and it's pretty clear that Colin Powell was not influenced by that, and this, therefore, that, I don't know, could have been part of the problem. But in any case, they believed in their cause. I don't think it's real power that caused them to pick on guys as well-known and as well-respected as Colin Powell or Tony Zinni. I think it was just arrogance and hubris that caused him to do that. You know, they're like a bully. You know, bullies aren't necessarily that strong, and they're certainly not very smart, but they act the part, and they intimidate people. And that's, I think, how these guys operate. But, yeah, I mean, they're still in place. None have been fired. You've got Wolfowitz over at the World Bank. Lord knows what he's doing over there, but he's over there, and that is very much a reward position. So they must have some hook still into the White House. Certainly Cheney, but even the White House, because they're in positions of honor, even though they are extremely dishonorable. And I think this IG report, you know, lays that out in just one more way.
Now, besides General Zinni and General Powell, these guys also marginalized the career officers, the regular bureaucrats and you know, busybodies and so forth inside the Pentagon and their professional capacities, that they all got ran out or moved to desks where they wouldn't really have much influence. Is this Feith just bringing up questions about intelligence, this part of that?
Well, I don't, you know, we haven't seen the complete report. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that, well, at least from my perspective and what I saw, is that if you were opposed to this, to the neocon agenda in the Pentagon or in Intel, you were going to be shunted off to the side. And I tell a story about one of the DIA briefers, an SES, senior executive service guy, who was assigned to Bill Luddy to give him his intelligence in the whole region. And he had a staff of five or six people, all trained intelligence people, belonging to Defense Intelligence Agency, at the beck and call of Bill Luddy for Middle East Intelligence. And what they told him was so disagreeable to Bill Luddy, so inconsistent with the fantasy that they were all embracing, that when I arranged a trip, I was told either Bill Luddy will go or the DIA SES will go, but neither of them will go on the same trip because Bill Luddy will not set foot in the room with his own intelligence advisor. And this is a professional career intelligence guy at the flag officer level. But that was their attitude. So yeah, I mean, to me, that's like shunting them aside. Mm-hmm. You could debate what that's called, but whatever it is, it's called not listening to the smart people who are trained to do their job and who are doing their job because they're not telling you your fantasy. I mean, these people are like, it'd be funny, but it seems like maybe we could, take them in for counseling on some reality TV show, you know, and see what's wrong with some of these neocons, because they clearly have something that a psychologist or a psychiatrist could probably help with. But no, they were running the show, not grounded in reality at all, making their own reality. As even, who's the famous guy? Is it Rove or somebody who said, "We make our own reality"? That's how they think, and that's what they were doing. And I think the IG has, to some extent, captured what they were doing. Again, too late to save any lives, as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
I don't see how this IG report can be credited with saving any lives.
Well, if it helps get us out of Iraq any faster now, I guess that'd be a little
that could
bit.
Be, yeah, if it helps, if it assists, if it gives some fuel to some congressmen, if it gives some congressmen some backbone to stand up for what they know is right, or I don't know, maybe not what they know it's right, but how about what 75-80% of the Americans want them to do?
Yeah, what's politically expedient?
You know, politics.
Yeah.
Who knew democracy could work that way? Well, actually, it doesn't, but, you know, that'd be nice if they would listen to the American people. And maybe this will help push them in that direction.
Well, now, you also mentioned the Likud connection there that these guys have to the right-wing parties in Israel. And there's an anecdote that you tell in your article, Open Door Policy, for the American Conservative Magazine, about, supposedly escorting but really chasing after some Israeli generals who came to visit Doug Feith.
That's right. Yeah, and they barged in on him, too. I mean, it wasn't even as if they really respected him. They were like, you know, where's our boy? But that's just my observation. I mean, I saw it happen. I'm not the only one that saw it happen. We didn't have these folks sign in. They were special. And that's okay. You know, it's good to be special. I'm all about being special. But not when it gets people killed and not when it destroys our reputation and destroys whole countries, which, of course, is what we've done. And I think what we intended to do, really. I think we intended to put bases in there to facilitate further hegemony over oil and to facilitate a long-term strategy that Israel has had to make sure that nobody supports the Palestinians. And, of course, since Saddam's gone, there is nobody really supporting him. He was the only one of the Arab leaders who stood up consistently and said, the Palestinians might have a case here. Why don't we listen to it? And, there's nobody doing that now. And you can be sure our little puppet in Baghdad's not doing that.
Yeah, so do you think when Fife didn't bother coming up with a war plan, that basically what he was hoping for was at least if they couldn't get their Hashemite kingdom or Chalabi or something, that plan B or C was to just go ahead and turn the country over to complete chaos?
Well, you know, there never was a plan B or C written. What these neocons in the Pentagon, what these Friends of Israel and certain other folks who were making our foreign policy, what they were thinking amongst themselves is not clear. It would certainly be the utmost of not just illegal but immoral, you know, to actually propose that we're going to go create chaos. But if you think about it as a strategy, certainly not unprecedented, certainly a very common strategy. In fact, even a common strategy among dictators. And perhaps like Putin said, I don't know exactly what he said, but apparently he said that America kind of has overreached our bounds. I think Putin sees this country as perceiving itself not as a global policeman, but as a global dictator. And if we are a dictator, then causing our little subordinates to fuss and fight amongst themselves, to not trust each other, to be unable to develop any sense of community, much less nationalism, it's a good thing.
Yeah, that's divide and conquer, the imperial strategy.
Divide and conquer, you got it. Now, if you put divide and conquer in a war plan as plan B, well, first we'll liberate and put our Hashemite kingdom in. Second, if that doesn't work, we'll divide and conquer. Well, you know, I don't know if that would sell. So, and I've never seen it written down that way. But I don't think they're at all displeased. And if you look at Doug Fife's words, and I've been looking at what he's been saying, he seems very pleased.
Well, he's the guy that told Bremer. He's the guy that made Bremer, or I guess the two of them together, decided to fire not just the Iraqi army, mm-hmm. but every single government employee who was mm-hmm. a member of the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, when we debate what they were trying to do, when we try to figure it out, either it was by design, which is, of course, terribly immoral, or they didn't intend to do it, but they did it because they actually believed that if we fired all of the people that knew anything about Iraqi government, it would help their building of a new country. If that's true, then Tommy Franks is right, okay? And Doug Fife is really the stupidest, you know, effing guy in the planet. That's what Tommy said. He's not right about a lot of things. Maybe he was right about this. And that would mean that they're innocent, but they're stupid. Now, I don't think they're stupid. So I tend to go with that they probably, you know, wanted it this way.
Well, Karen,
but close.
There's been a lot of drumbeat lately about the idea of spreading this war into Iran.
Oh, sure.
And I'm sure you know the Forward has reported in the past that Michael Rubin, among others, at the Office of Special Plans, even back in the days when you were there, mm-hmm. had already opened up a desk to work on Iran policy. And, of course, Larry Franklin,
he was sitting in OSP. I mean, OSP included the Iran desk. Iran was not kept separate. It was included in OSP along with the Iraq
program. So you were witness to that back in 2002, mm-hmm. that they were already working on Iran there.
Yep. Now, I don't know what their plans were, and Iran is a different kind of bird.
They weren't passing around those kind of talking points about Iran like they did Iraq.
No. There was, though, as you would find at the Ford and lots of other places, a lot of anxiety and contempt and hatred for Iran, you know, a lot of enemy-making. Just the words, you know, the language has always been very anti-Iran. In fact, even in this country, since the Ayatollah, I mean, you know, this is an easy sell for Americans, unfortunately, because, you know, a lot of people do remember. They don't remember when we set up our own guy in Iran years ago, but they do remember when Iran took back their country under the Ayatollah, under that, dictatorship of sorts. And so we have a lot of negative images of Iran, and these are easy to fan up. You know, their embers are easy to turn into a big fire, and I think that's what the intention is. And Bush has got how many more, 2 years left, year and a half?
Sure. Well, and we know also that Abe Shulsky is still working at the OSP.
Abe's in a position where he can make some lessons from any mistakes they might have made in Iran, in Iraq, and then apply propaganda program for Iran. But I mean, we're already seeing that. I mean, this whole idea of all these devices, the improvised explosive device technology. Oh, Iran is sending it over. It can only come from Iran. Lots and lots of interesting things, which all point to continued propaganda to expand this war. And really, if you think about it, what are you going to do? You either have to leave Iraq or you have to make it worse.
Right, I mean,
there's no middle point here. People are not going to, American people are not going to put up with it, and the Congress knows it. They're not going to put up with no change in plans. Something has to change. Now, the American people might get their soldiers back, and the neocon agenda will have at least be stopped for now. Or we can turn this into a bigger war, and the American people will very reliably fall into place, and I think that's what they're counting on. And certainly, look, the war makes money for a lot of people. Why not?
Yeah, it costs the rest of us, but what the hell?
Take on Iran. Let's let them, you know, hey, if they bomb a couple of, if they take out a couple carriers and battleships, what's wrong with that? We can build new ones. That's just $100 billion.
Oh.
Or more. Come
on. That's a cynical attitude.
Let's kill some more Americans and get Americans all hyped up, and then we'll consent to further things. It can be Iraq Redux. I really think that they don't care.
Well, the neocons always meant for Iraq to merely be Act One.
That's right.
And they've been saying this whole time that, hey,
mm-hmm.
George, you have to do Iran Two, or else the Iraq project doesn't work. It doesn't stand by itself.
That's right. And also, if Iraq ends on a down note, on a failed note, which, of course, as you started out with this, I mean, the military knows this is unsustainable, and it's going to be a failure. It is a failure now, and when it ends, it will be historically recorded as not just a failure, but a failure of the worst kind, one that was preventable. And so they're telling George Bush, look, you know, yeah, you got reelected, Daddy didn't, but your legacy will be even worse than your father's if you don't complete this mission, which
mm-hmm.
is a neoconservative mission, which does include, I think, something to do with the destruction or the turmoil, increased turmoil in Iran. And I'm sure that that's what they want to do. It just seems like it, and all the evidence points this way. The things you read point that way. And I, unfortunately, it'll be an easy sell for Americans because many Americans, ignorant as we are, have a negative view of Iran. From our own watching of the news in the 70s and the 80s, we associate Iran with bad things. We expect bad things from them, and propagandizing us to invade or attack or retaliate or defend ourselves against Iran will be an easy sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty sad, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. I kind of think that's where they're going. Unless Congress can institute impeachment against Cheney and Bush and some other officials. If the Congress could do that, I think they might be able to stop it.
Well, there's a great segue into my last question for you. You end your article for Salon.com, The New Pentagon Papers, by quoting Benjamin Franklin and his admonition that what they'd done was created a republic if we can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd just like to give you a chance to kind of give that call to action to people out there to join in. You're fighting the good fight, and how can they help, Karen?
I don't know, but I think the republic is being held on by a thin thread. But congressmen still respond to their constituents, and it seems that, you know, what we can do is we can talk to them. We can march, and not just on Saturdays, maybe on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Let's shut down Washington. I got this idea from another guy who pointed out that all these protests are on the weekend, and that's not how it should be. And we need to communicate with the people in the Congress. I mean, you know, the alternative is, of course, to overthrow the government or to let our government fail, and we'll start over. Those are options. Okay, I'm perfectly prepared for that. But I think, you know, the nice way to go about it would be to really communicate with whoever the representatives and congressmen are, call them up, go visit them, and talk to them about how you feel. And we don't want a war. We want this guy out of here. He's a corrupt criminal. Bush, Cheney, a number of people that they've appointed have broken laws. Okay, they have gone against the Constitution, and that is impeachment worthy. We had a little practice with Clinton on some things that are impeachment worthy, and it doesn't take much. So we should really proceed along those lines. Otherwise, we can prepare ourselves for further death and destruction in the Middle East and for the loss of American lives and for the loss of our own liberties here. I mean, these are the choices, so people can do what they want. If it gets much worse, I think our country is in big trouble, and we may indeed get an opportunity to start over. you know, there's nothing you can plan for that one.
All right, everybody. Karen Katowski, she writes regularly for LouRockwell.com and MilitaryWeek.com. And please check out her articles. Career Officer, there's eye-opening stint in the Pentagon for Knight Ritter. The New Pentagon Papers for Salon.com. In Rumsfeld's Shop for the American Conservative Magazine. And Soldier for the Truth for LA Weekly. Thanks a lot, Karen.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. Good talking to you.